tonight is anniversary night. The format. The format of tonight's meeting will be a main speaker who will speak for 25 minutes, followed by our information break and the anniversary celebrants. Our main speaker tonight is George.
Hi, my name is George and I'm an alcoholic. First of all, welcome to any newcomers. Friends of AA and people coming back, you're absolutely in the right place, and I hope at the end of what I have to say, that'll be even more confirmed. Thank you also for asking me to speak. It's a tremendous honor to speak here, and it's an even more tremendous honor to be speaking here when there are anniversary celebrants in the room, and the miracle of what AA can do and is doing is so dramatically on display. Let me tell you a bit about myself, some stats. My sobriety date is September 26, 1983. This is my home group. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I work with sponsees. I'm forever working on the ninth step and living in 10, 11, and 12. I'm originally from Western Canada. I came from a town that was founded to stamp out the whiskey trade in that part of the world. So you can imagine how that went. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My father was an alcoholic. He died 50 years ago of alcoholism. I had a younger brother who died, committed suicide due to drugs and alcohol 20 years after that. I have uncles and cousins who are alcoholic. And from the earliest time, I knew that alcohol was baffling and powerful, even if I didn't know anything else about it. Anything that can turn your home into a blast zone on no notice is something that is both fearful, fearsome, and fascinating, and that's what it was to me. And as soon as I could think about it, I said, I'm never going to touch it, which, as you can see, that also worked out about as well as it did for my hometown. My response to the conditions I was living in was to crawl up into my head. I learned to read as fast as I could, and I lived in books as much as I possibly could. Books were, I thought, safe. Books were an imaginary universe where someone with self-centered fear can actually be the center of their universe. And that that suited me just fine. I learned very quickly also at an early age what I thought of then as the two most powerful words in the English language. Those words are, I'm fine. And the first meaning of I'm fine to me was, go away. And the second meaning was, see how easy it is to lie to yourself. And then ultimately it was a way of rolling a tombstone across my feelings. It was my most important act of self-will almost every single day of the week. So I was already living in a hallucinatory world. The second step of our program says that it takes a power greater than ourselves to return us to sanity, but the important word for me early on was sanity. I really think that fear kept me out of the world of real people. Some people hide in malls, and I hid in school. I turned out to be good at that, so I became a school rat. And it seemed like a much better place than any of the other places that I could be in. And because it was easy, it helped foster the feelings of arrogance and superiority that I used to cover the fact that I didn't feel that way at all. If I was singular, if I was unique, if I was apart, which is how I felt, that was mostly because I felt like being that way and because the rest of you weren't quite up to me. That's an incredibly dangerous way to live. And in the middle of my I'm fines, I, among other things, used to go out onto the prairies around our house and start fires, which I learned later in life from professional psychological people is a really bad sign. And that the three R's I was learning in school turned out mostly to be reading, rage, and resentment. I once burned myself badly doing this, and I never told anybody about it, which was quite remarkable, since it kind of showed. But I would rather suffer that kind of pain than tell you that I was in it. And that made the next step in my transition to full-blown alcoholism pretty easy, because at the age of 12, I forgot about my vow never to drink. I was tending a punch bowl at my parents' party, and I tried it. And people talk about it loosening them up and making them more sociable. But in my case, I absolutely wasn't interested in being more sociable. I was interested in unconsciousness, and that's what I did. I got drunk immediately, got sick, and passed out. And that was the way I was going to drink. To me, alcohol was a way out of any world. And that's the way I felt it should be. I never touched alcohol again through high school. I was too smart, and you were all too weak. So I didn't have anything to do with it. And that lasted until I got to college. And then when I went away to college, the first thing that happened was exactly the same thing that happened when I was 12. I got drunk. I passed out. But this time, there was no vow not to stop. Everything that had happened in my family, everything that alcohol had done that made me fearful, went away. From then on, it was my complete crutch. It did not improve me socially very much, I have to say. I spent most of 1 year in college in a bathtub with an espresso maker and a bottle of vodka, and that was about it most of the time. I still have absolutely no idea how I got out of college, but somehow I did, and it moved me on to the next thing in my story, which is pretty much of a constant, which was escape. If alcohol was going to take me out of whatever world I was in, I was also going to take me out of whatever geography I was in, and I began running. I moved east to eastern Canada and hung out there for a while, and moved to New York. Oh, it's getting to be about 40 years ago, because, among other things, I figured this was the place where smart people went. I could leave all those boring people behind that I knew everywhere else, and I could live the life that I wanted to live. There were only a couple of problems. I had a family. That was one problem. I had a wife and a small child who we didn't find out then, but we found out subsequently was learning disabled. But that did not slow me down. I still remember one of the first things I saw in downtown Manhattan when I got here was a bar on the corner of 13th and 5th. It had a huge statue of an iguana on the roof and a big sign that said, "Too much ain't enough." And I thought, they knew I was coming. I mean, this is exactly what I want in bars. This is exactly what I want in my life. I want an excess in which I don't have to be accountable for anything that I do. The fact that I was like that already was already a pretty big danger sign for anybody who cared to look, which I didn't. And most of the people that I hung out with tended to be more like me. It says in our literature that we lead a double life, and that's exactly what I began to do. I may have had a family at home, but I had a job that had highly erratic hours, and we're talking a while ago, we kind of had a madman atmosphere to it. Anyway, they delivered bottles of scotch on Friday night to your office on a tray. It was great. So I didn't go home, pretty much. And I had developed a real love for blackouts. I was not interested in merely getting a buzz on and being nice with anybody else. There's something about the state of oblivion that I found just irresistible, at the same time that I found it terrifying. And when I came out of blackouts, I guess part of the thrill was that I was still alive, because I knew I had no control whatsoever of what had happened to me at all. I came out of one blackout in the middle of midtown Manhattan, and somebody taken a razor to my clothes, and I realized they could have bled out in the street. It didn't stop me. Nothing could, of course. It was a time of great terror. And ultimately, it was something I couldn't hold together anymore. I was suffering from all the things we do: alcohol poisoning, shakes, tremors, erratic behavior, total panics. I was very paranoid. I thought somebody was trying to kill me, which was accurate, actually. I just didn't know it was me. So finally, I did what I had taught myself to do. I decided I would move to South America because that would fix it. That would deal with the fact that my bosses were looking at me in a strange way. That would, the little chats people were having and occasional pamphlets about the employee assistance program that I might find scattered around. And I went to a place that everybody, let me rephrase that. I went to a place where absolutely nobody had wanted to go. This job had been open for 2 years because it was so terrible down there. So I thought, perfect. And on about 7 days' notice, I picked up a family, including a daughter who, by that time we did know, was learning disabled, and took them to Argentina and put them down in an apartment they'd arranged for me and said, I'll be back in a couple of weeks. I have to go to Brazil. And that established a pattern I was going to hold to for 2 years, but I was uneasily aware a little bit that if my father had been a binge drinker who would suddenly disappear for large periods of time, I had established a pattern that just beat him hollow. But I was too frightened to stop doing what I was doing. I had actually planned to go on from there to India. I thought I'd had a deal with the people I worked for that they would send me to India and I could continue to do the same thing. But it's at that point in my story that I first got a real intervention from God that I could recognize later as being one, which is that they suddenly called me home. Not because I was the drunk that I was, but because they had another job and they just figured they hadn't seen me for a couple of years, probably I could do it. And that turned out to be one of the luckiest things that ever happened to me. It did not stop me drinking. When I came back, the pattern that I'd established continued. I was in and out of blackouts. I was a shambling wreck. I was sleeping in my office. I was buying my clothes at department stores and staying there, which must have made my office a fairly interesting place to be for others, until I couldn't do it anymore. I stopped pretty dead cold. I could not stop drinking for any reason. I was drunk 24 hours a day. And finally, they sent me home. They said, you're drunk. Go home. Come back. Sober, please. And when I came back the next day, I wasn't sober at all. I was still drunk. And I sat in my office waiting to be fired. There's a kind of calm that comes over me as an alcoholic when I piled up enough chaos that I can finally see that my life is totally unmanageable. And I was in that moment. And a friend of mine who is not in the program, has nothing to do with AA, walked into my office and said, you know, you're really going to have to do something about this. And I said, yes, I know. I'm an alcoholic and I don't know what to do about it. And I think that's the first time that the word alcoholic had crossed my lips in 20 years. I think I'd buried it with my father and everything else. And the astonishing thing about it is that within half an hour of that moment, the craving for alcohol disappeared. It just went away. There was no way for me not to see that this was a miraculous event and that there was a power greater than myself that did it. I also think it was the first time I'd been in a room with the truth for a long time. And if there was part of that miracle that can be ascribed to me, it was that I was a channel for honesty for the first time in I don't know how long. So I went away to rehab like many of us have done. And I learned for the first time in my life that I had a disease, which was the biggest relief you can imagine. A disease was something I could do something about. A disease was something I could be accountable about. I didn't listen quite as carefully to the fact that it was also a spiritual as well as a mental and physical disease, but the disease part I got. And while I was there, they told me to come to AA. And I loved it. I started going to meetings immediately, and I grabbed AA with both my hands. And I was living in Connecticut at the time, and our meetings were small and far apart, and I spent most of my time running around in cars with other people going to meetings. I was with the program 3 or 4 hours a day, it seemed to me. And I started to get better. I don't know. I learned in that rehab, I should add, at one point that in one of those blackouts I favored, I'd tried to kill my wife, which was something that they brought up to me before I left. And for the first time in my life, I realized that whatever this alcoholic person was, that I could not possibly tame it myself. So I did what I was told. I got a sponsor. I did the steps. I went to a meeting every day for years, and I got better. I made amends. I suddenly had a life with my little girl that I hadn't had before. And the cash and prizes started. For some reason, nobody ever fired me. I can't figure that one out at all. So I kept my job, got better at my job, did other jobs, and everything was going great, which for me is a problem. Because slowly but certainly, I began to lose the fact that it was God, as I prefer to understand him, who was keeping me sober, and began to think that God was helping me keep myself sober. And the longer I went with that, the more I decided that I did not need God and I did not need the program. So slowly, an inch at a time, I edged away. I was helped by a few things. My marriage eventually broke up. I don't suppose that if you've tried to kill your wife in a blackout that there could be some kind of hint that you've got a problem or two. So I moved. I moved back to town. My sponsor moved away. He went to Boston. Maybe I don't need to get a sponsor quite the same way again. Maybe I don't need to have regular meetings. Maybe I don't need to be with the same people week in and week out who can tell me how I'm doing and what I'm doing. Maybe I don't need to go to meetings at all. It took years, but slowly and patiently I weaned myself away from this fellowship and away from the people in it. And I always had a good reason for doing it. I was a spiritual person. I like to look at religious art, after all. I had a very large collection of church music. The life of the spirit suddenly became, no, it's just my life, and I'm especially spiritual, and I didn't have to have anything to do with you or the program or anything else. And I stayed in touch loosely for long enough to convince myself that this was just an amicable parting. And that began a 10-year period away from this program. And 10 years are inching back into what I now think of as hell. Because slowly but surely, the personality that I had recovered began to deteriorate. And over time, I never, for some reason I now know was God's will and not mine, I didn't drink, but I became cynical, hostile, suspicious, cruel, unfeeling, self-centered. I became exactly the person I'd been before, but I didn't have any more blackouts. Until that, too, brought me to my knees. By that time, I had remarried. I'd had two children who never had seen me drink, but who were learning about untreated alcoholism just as surely as I had learned about the drinking kind. My life was falling apart. All the relationships in my life were beginning to disintegrate. And eventually, what saved me was the fact that I could remember what this program was like. The fact that my wife, for a couple of years, had been saying, maybe you should go back to AA, didn't make the difference. But what did make the difference is my memory of what it had been like. So eventually I did. By that time, I was living in Brooklyn. And so I went to a meeting. I went to a meeting as far away from my house as possible. It was almost like I was still recovering from drinking, because God knows I might run into somebody in AA who was from closer to my house than that. And I asked someone to be my sponsor, and they said no. I did not use that as an excuse to go away, and asked someone else who did say yes. And they brought me here, to this room, and to you. I went through the steps again. I rediscovered the fact that it had not been me not drinking all along, that it had been the power of God and the power of this fellowship. And I learned more and more about service. I now think that service is the most important human connection that I have, and especially service in this fellowship, and I try very hard to do as much service as I can. I also try to remember that it was not being told about alcohol, about the miracle of sobriety that kept Bill Wilson sober. It's talking to other alcoholics that kept Bill Wilson sober. It's the act of making that human connection that is utterly important to my sobriety. And I learned about gratitude in a completely different way. I'm no longer grateful for not being sick. I am profoundly grateful to be in the company of you. I am profoundly grateful to be in the company of God as I understand him. And I am profoundly grateful for the fact that I can do service to other people in this program and elsewhere. I know that my sobriety is a miracle because I've tried doing without it twice, and I have not been able to do it. Nor have I, but I also did not preserve it by myself. And I can hold on to those two things when everything else gets particularly distressing. But there is another miracle I want to talk about, and that matters to me a great deal. Is when my father died in 1966, to the best of my knowledge, he'd never had the hand of AA reach out to him. And when my brother died, he died alone, as we often tend to do. I consider that my sobriety is a miracle, but the other miracle in my life is the miracle called AA. Bill Wilson said that people have been getting being alcoholics as long as man has been crushing grapes, and that's probably 5,000 or 6,000 years that we know about. We have 80 years of AA. And the last thing I want to leave you with is that even though I have often been told to stay here until a miracle happens, and I want to say that to all newcomers, I also want to say that as long as you're here, the miracle is also you. And thank you very much for my sobriety.